In 2007, the Babylon podcast was our last best hope for more Lost Tales. We thought it failed. But after WonderCon, it became something more. Our last best hope for more Lost Tales geeking. The year is 2008. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast. And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And we have no Jeffrey today. At least not yet.
Now.
I'll be the stand-in Vorlon.
I think he's lost in the catacombs of VH1 where he's not getting any cell reception in the back hallway or something.
Sure, that's it.
Yeah,
that could be.
But
it could also be that he's off doing a good thing and having a positive impact on the world around us. Well, we're just talking about a dumb science fiction show.
But we do have a studio guest.
Mm-hmm. Good
evening.
Yes. Say hi.
Hello.
We have James Paul, who's in the chat, known in the chat room as Psychomer. So.
And over here from the East Coast to partake of the events surrounding the landing of the Phoenix lander on Mars recently.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Yeah. And that involves visiting the Science Operations Center at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Plug. And I figured, well, being this close, how can I turn down the opportunity to watch the magic of the Babylon podcast?
It's so magical. But we like it.
It would be pretty easy, I would think.
We like him over here because he brought us a really nice bottle of Corlejo.
And this is why Jeffrey needed to be here.
Yes, he really did. I wanted to rub it in because I know he's on the shoot right now and there's no way he could enjoy a nice glass of this wonderful stuff. Even bought the Anejo, bought the good stuff.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wasn't sure.
Oh, that's the good stuff. You did well. And he gave us a nice donation to help kind of pay for some of the stuff around here, which is always a good thing.
So, James, are you out here? This trip, is it a business trip or just out?
Well, actually, I'm on vacation, but my vacation, much to the consternation of my colleagues, is to go visiting federal facilities, universities, places where research and development is being done. And I've always tried to be at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory whenever we're having some sort of major mission event, like landings on other planets or putting orbiters around other planets.
Always a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've come to call it my favorite place in the universe.
So what's the atmosphere like when you're in a room like that?
They are very, very nervous. Although before the sequence actually gets started, they do conceal it pretty well. But once the telemetry starts coming down and they are kicking off the events in the timeline. This time the project manager had his fingers wrapped very tightly around his chair and started pushing it back and forth. And I was convinced at some point he was going to just shove it right through all of the consoles and out the front the front wall. In contrast to the Mars Polar Lander episode back in 1999, where it disappeared one day and nobody ever heard from it again, and you saw some very glum faces, these folks got happier and happier because this thing just clicked off the events just like they had planned, and it was a very complex sequence. They had at least 26 pyrotechnic events that had to come off to release things like parachutes and heat shields and all the other stuff, and it couldn't have gone any better. And even the last few meters where they were depending on these pulse thrusters, it worked just like they expected it to. What was even more amazing with this one was that because they had the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter in the proper orbit and the navigation was so good, they actually got pictures of the vehicle coming down on the parachute, and they also managed to find the the lander on the ground, and you can see the parachute in the back shell. You can also see the heat shield in the area, but the camera's good enough now that you can actually see the solar panels as they were deployed. So you can there were a bunch of very happy people. The press conference afterward, they didn't do as much dancing around there as I thought they would, but during the scene in the control room, there was a lot of hugging going on.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, that's also a mission to the Martian pole, correct?
This is, Phoenix landed in the North Polar region.
Okay.
Mars Polar Lander was aimed at the South Polar region. They hit almost exactly where they intended to go. Apparently, the parachute was a little late coming out, so they landed a little bit off of the precise target, but they were within the ellipse that they had laid out.
Excellent. Now, when does the science start on this?
Well, they had a bit of a glitch on the radio relay on Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, so they fell about a day behind. The problem they've got now is that they have to take the arm and they have to train it where it is in Martian space. So the principal investigator was asked a question, and he said, well, after we land, my students are going to go into our simulator room, and they're going to start pouring dirt and putting rocks in so that it looks exactly like the scene we see in front of us, and then we will start moving the arm to particular positions, and that will give us the coordinates for knowing where we want to put the arm to actually do the science. That's going to take a few days. I'm hoping that when I go to the operations center tomorrow that they will have actually unlimbered the arm and started moving it around, but the science probably won't start until next week.
Wow. Now, this is to look for organic material?
That's correct.
Yeah.
They have a couple of small laboratories, and basically they will dig soil up. Hopefully they will get ice particles. They will put it in the laboratories, and they hope that they will be able to detect carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, which will tell you that you've had some type of organic material there.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be, they say it's not at the level of DNA. Those molecules are just too big. But right. If you can show that the precursor materials are there, then you can argue that the possibility exists somewhere that more complex forms may have come along.
Now,
it's obvious that they really need to. I mean, we all know they need to send one to Sirius Planum. I mean, let's stop messing around with poles and.
The SciCorps would never permit that. You know, they've controlled the minds of everybody to make sure that target never comes up in the discussion.
Good point.
Wow.
Well, what do you think, Summer? Take a break and come back with some deep geeking?
Yes, we are going to delve deeply into the episode Falling Towards Apotheosis.
On the next Babylon 5.
Millions of people's lives are at stake.
As the Vorlons escalate their destruction.
Attacking any world, any base.
Sheridan must make a decision.
If the ambassador stays, billions more will die. So we're going to take out the Vorlon.
But will he survive his own trap?
John!
On the next.
I did the best I could.
Babylon 5.
You may be the world's best guitar hero player, Fast Finger Kid, but one of these people is having the best week ever.
I'm so happy for everyone.
Everybody was happy. Nobody was hurt.
Wow, that is amazing.
It's everything you love.
Hey,
You know, I had a bad day at the office, and I need a hug.
You know that feeling?
Everything you missed.
I am resigning from the office of governor.
Absurd.
And all the stuff you need to see again.
Every man thinks about sex.
No, really, think about it.
The best week ever.
That sounds complex.
Yeah, I'll look how I keep doing this.
So, what's a geeked out fangirl and self-proclaimed pop culture junkie to do when she's hundreds, if not thousands of miles removed from her friends and family, living in the middle of North Texas of all places with a bunch of Navy guys, and working at the most boring and monotonous job she could ever have imagined herself in? Why, start a podcast, of course. Hi, I'm Lisa, the host of Hypersensitive, the weekly podcast where I talk about all the pop culture-y things that are vying for my easily distracted attention. I talk about TV, movies and DVDs, music, other podcasts, and pretty much anything else that would interest and entertain your average teenager. Except that I'm a 33-year-old lawyer. But whatever. Plus, at the end of every episode, I share a playlist of 10 new songs that I've added to my iPod that I think y'all would enjoy. So check it out at hypersensitive.podbean.com. Come on, you know you want to know what I thought of last week's episodes of Lost, Grey's Anatomy, and Gossip Girl. Besides, you don't have to tell anyone you listen. Hypersensitive.podbean.com. Go, now, go!
Digging down into the most obscure facts and fandom, this is
And we are back with more Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm still Tim Callender.
And we still have James.
Hello.
Because you can never have too much James in your diet.
I guess so.
Well, he said he admitted to us off mic that it's been a while since he's seen this episode, and he's not really sure if he can contribute or not. But if he has something, he'll pipe up.
Well, James, let me just offer one name to you. And just tell me the first thing that pops in your mind, okay?
All right.
All right, ready? Cartasia.
Well, let's see. I'm not sure lunatic really really covers everything that sort of flows around when his image pops into you.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that struck me, well, and we should let all our listeners know that tonight we are geeking on Falling Toward Apotheosis.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched the episode, and then I went back and listened to the commentary. It had Bruce Boxleitner, Jerry Doyle, and Peter Jurczyk, and Pat Tallman. And it was a blast to listen to and not at all informative. It was very funny. But one of the things I opened up with was trying to define apotheosis, and eventually Jurczyk comes up with it. And, of course, they all accused him of running to his Webster's. but it means to attain godhood.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you get with Cartasia. He is striving for godhood. And, of course, the flip side of the coin is Sheridan, who might have it thrust upon him or has fallen into it. But
mm-hmm. Yeah,
the thing that's
I'd say kicking the shiznit out of a Vorlon requires, you know, people thinking you're approaching godhood.
Well, there's an opening scene where they're in the waiting room, the transfer point where all the ships load and unload their passengers, and it's utter chaos. And this woman nearly gets trampled, and then, of course, Sheridan reaches down and helps her. And then right after that, he's walking with Lorien, just sort of down a dark corridor. And he says, and the conversation is one like, you know what they're saying about you. So something to that effect is Lorien. So I can't remember the exact dialogue, but basically says, you know, they're talking about you like you're a god. And he's like, well, I'm not. But then Lorien says, you can't save them all. And Sheridan says, I can try.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You'll fail. We'll see. And it's like, on the one hand, he's rejecting the title, but on the other hand, he's embracing that role. You know, it's the one thing now that's rallying all the League worlds, what's left of the League of Non-Aligned worlds, all the other races. You know, the fleet assembles at Babylon 5. It's the biggest fleet anybody's ever seen in history. And why? Only because John Sheridan has come back from the dead from Zahadum.
Yeah. He's returned from the dead. He says, you know what? We can end this forever. Your great-great-grandchildren, your descendants 1,000 years from now won't have to play this stupid game ever again. You'll be free to make your own mark on the universe.
Yep. But first, we got to get rid of the Vorlon.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Jeffrey. I think it's the last time he shows up in a major way.
Aw.
Well, we'll have to give him a hard time about that.
Yes.
You know, and I you know, I don't even know where to describe that. There is that whole dynamic between Sheridan and Garibaldi. You know, he's got the whole twitchy thing going on from whatever the Psi-Corps did to him.
Mm-hmm.
Except that there are these moments where it's Garibaldi showing through. It's, you know, I mean, it's just when Sheridan says, okay, we got to get rid of Vorlon, but Michael, I can't tell you anything about it because he might read your mind. And Garibaldi's like, yep, okay, fine. I'll follow my sword. If that's what you want, go take out the Vorlon. Okay, you know, I'm marching to my doom.
Like, sure, no problem. He'll just wipe the floor with all of us and we'll just, yeah, you just continue
right.
on. Yeah, just, no problem.
Yeah. And sure enough, when they go in there, I mean, they're all like, okay, you know, the ambassador, we're going to have to ask you to leave. And the bad Kosh goes, no. They start shooting at him, and they can't even touch him. He's just sitting there looking at him.
Yep. I like,
then,
yeah, that
yeah,
just,
ahead.
Yeah, that just was funny. It was like, yeah, we're gonna, you see this little, yeah, make me.
Yeah, right, with your little pop gun pea shooters. You know, of course, then, you know, Garibaldi is repulsed, and his attempt is repulsed. Lita then tries to lure the ambassador out, but the Vorlon knows that something's up. But he figures it out just about the point in time he stands on the pad of doom. David Eagle directed this episode.
Yes.
If you remember in Point of No Return, that great shot that you love so much, Summer, the push-pull shot with Sheridan. Do you notice they do it again with the Vorlon?
Yep.
Like, oh boy, something bad's going to happen.
I don't know what it is about that type of shot that just kind of fascinates me. I have
it's
no
really dramatic.
Idea.
I mean, it really is dramatic.
I'm going to have to sit down and figure that out. I don't know if it's whether it's making you focus on a certain event and you have to replay in your mind, okay, what just happened that led to this? Because this is a turning point for some reason. I don't know. Maybe.
Well, the thing is, I mean, from a visual standpoint, the shot is extremely effective because it runs counterintuitive. In other words, as you push in on the foreground subject, in this case, the Vorlon ambassador, you would think that when you physically walk towards something, it gets closer, everything gets closer. This is one of those cases where the foreground object comes closer, but the background recedes. So that gives it that extra sort of drama and that sort of friction, if you will. It's like, wait a minute, something is not right here. You know, something's topsy-turvy. Now, I wanted to ask you, Summer, what's your opinion on this? When Ulkesh breaks out of his encounter suit, and his helmet explodes. Watching it twice, I wasn't quite sure whether it was because they were just dosing it with so much power that something had to give, or that it was the Vorlon was just so pissed off that he wasn't going to do anything nice like gently open his encounter suit. He was just going to come out.
I think there was a buildup of energy and anger, rage is a very powerful emotion, no matter what species has it. So I'm just thinking at this point, he feels he's being betrayed by these little sheep that he's supposed to be herding that he really doesn't care for.
Right.
And he just kind of busts out. And this is, we're going to have to talk to Jeffrey more about this, because this is the episode, like he said, that they rigged it with too much explosive. It wasn't supposed to blow apart into shards like that. It was just supposed to burst open into like 2 or 3 or 4 pieces.
Yeah, the thing shatters. I mean,
yes,
completely
it completely shatters. And one of those shattered pieces is the piece of Kosh he gave me.
Oh, you are the luckiest girl in school.
I know. He likes me. He really, really likes me. I was just like, oh my God, I have a piece of Kosh. It's cool. But yeah, I definitely want to talk to him about that because, you know, it wasn't supposed to break like that. But well, yeah, that's like, you things, know, yeah, the Vorlon.
Speaking of things breaking, we mm-hmm. got Kosh coming out of Sheridan.
Mm-hmm.
And the two Koshes fight.
Yeah.
The Koshes, they're all Kesh's ship is basically escaping.
Mm-hmm.
The energy of the two Koshes eventually wrap up around that ship and it explodes. And I'm not quite sure whether that was our Kosh trying to, you know, take down everything. In other words, you know, the ship can't run for the Vorlon homeworld and report. I don't know. I mean, it's open to interpretation, and I like that, but it's an interesting conflict.
Well, the thing is it wouldn't matter because the Vorlons would know that Olkesh was gone.
And it may not matter to them at this point anyways. They're already well on their rampage of destroying planets all through the galaxy. So if they lose one member, you know, apparently it is very important to the Vorlons to get any psychic remnant of one of their own. I mean, that's the whole deal. I mean, that's one of the things that pulls Lita, or that Lita uses to pull Olkesh out. He says, well, I think I know where Kosh is.
Yeah.
And the Vorlon's like, intolerable, and a human. Ugh.
Right.
So that has some importance. So I wonder if that's part of good Kosh's vengeance.
I wouldn't call it vengeance. I would call it, you know, his last act to save the younger races that he actually became affectionate for. I mean, you know, he liked the humans. He liked the Minbari. He cared about what happened to them.
Oh, he's definitely a mentor to Sheridan, too.
Yeah. So yeah. I look at
his father in his dreams. I mean, that's significant.
Yeah. And I look at that as you know, Kosh's last act to protect, you know, his kids, you know, you know, continuing the metaphor, the younger members that he had shepherded to the point where they could actually do this.
May I interrupt with a question at this point?
Sure.
Something that occurred, that I got to wondering about, what is it that tells the good Kosh that he needs to leave that piece of himself behind, since the follow-on ambassador hasn't really shown up yet. I don't know if he knew who would replace him if he was lost, but I'm just sort of wondering, how does he know that Sheridan is going to need that little extra bit in order to deal with the follow-on Vorlon?
Well, it wasn't about need at the time. I mean, he had no idea that this was going to happen. He just wanted to break off a piece of himself and save it because that's what they do. And he chose...
Well, I think the other part of it is he was... Despite his pronouncement, if you go to Zahadum, you will die. He was also, I really sincerely think that he put himself inside Sheridan as opposed to anybody else because he knew that Lorian was there and he knew that it was one last desperate hope to keep Sheridan alive. Because he's the one who tells Sheridan to jump. Sheridan was very willing to stand there and let the White Star come down and nuke him along with everybody else.
Hmm.
So I truly believe that it was as much an act of trying to be there again, as you said, Summer, one last time for you know his pupil, not strictly out of self-preservation,
and sort of turn around the prophecy. If you go to Zahadum, you will die. Unless I'm there with you, because I know that there's that one out by jumping into the hole and finding Lorian,
right,
who is waiting for somebody to arrive in order to act.
Right. Although he couldn't, you know, I mean, at that point, you can't really tell Sheridan that because then that... Mm-hmm.
Well, he kind of did.
That changes the nature. Well, but that changes the nature of that whole action. If Sheridan goes there with a slim hope that he might live out of it all, that...
He doesn't make
that
the leap.
Changes, yeah, that changes how he will respond to things. In other words, Sheridan goes to Zahadum knowing he's going to die, and he goes anyway. You know, and that's the mark of the kind of man he is. You know, as Sebastian tells him, you know, what greater love has one man for another that he lays down his life?
And it may also
you're
be
the right person in the right place at the right time.
It may also be the signal that Lorian needs that this is the person that you've been waiting for.
Yeah.
Right. That's a good point, James. Yes. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, we already know that Kosh kind of gave him a hint. You know, the man in between is waiting for you.
That's right.
Okay. Guess what? He's in between Tick and Tock. There he is.
Now we get to the point, though, after that, when Kosh leaves Sheridan and obviously kills him again, I guess. And Summer, I've been doing my homework and trying to give it some thought. And again, I just have to simply accept that this is the you know, part of the story. Here comes Lorian, and he pumps a little more life force into him. And despite all the later pronunciations that it's not magic, you know, it's just energy transference. And Franklin looks Sheridan over and said, yeah, there's some bioengineering going on and doing something and generating your cells. You know, it's magic. Mm. You know, it's
biological nanites. They're organic nanites.
At least it's not midichlorians. Thank you very much.
No, they're not midichlorians because that's just crap. But no, they're organic. They're organic technology, like the Vorlons in the Shadows use. Only they're organic nanites rebuilding his cells and keeping him running, and their internal mini, super mini nuclear batteries are just going to go one day.
Yeah, okay.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. No.
That's fine. Like I said, it's the one thing that I have problems choking down, and I just have to take my medicine and go on. Because, you know, the flip side of it is there's this very poignant scene afterwards with Delenn and Sheridan. You know, and she's like 20 years. He goes, it'll be a great run. It's going to be a good run. I'll be 60. We'll get everything done that we need to get done. You know, and she's like, you went to Zahad Doom. I couldn't stand, you know, I knew if you came back, I couldn't stand to lose you again. And now I know I'm going to lose you again.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to play devil's advocate. Why do you have problems with those? Yet, you know, what's the difference between what he says is in Sheridan and the Technomage developed little thing from Crusade? Remember they picked up the empty shells, the dead, the inert nanites, and reprogrammed them with one duty to protect people from the Drock virus. What's the difference?
One is
sufficiently more advanced technology than the other. It's still technology.
I understand that, and I will freely admit that I don't have a logical explanation at this point. It's simply emotion. The difference is that it comes back to the whole different the idea that you've got the first being there of all beings bringing people back to life. I mean, I guess the difference is that if One is a protection, and I think, and as arbitrary as this sounds, it's people working this technology to at least give them a temporary benefit, as opposed to God in the whole saying, okay, I'll bring you back to life. I'm telling you, Summer, I'm not even expecting to change your mind or anybody's mind. I'm just telling you, it's the one part of the story that just kind of tastes bad a little bit. And, I mean, you know, frankly, when we get to Sleeping in Light, we're going to be sitting there talking about it. I'm going to be crying my eyes out because it is one of the most perfect finales I've ever seen to any series ever. And it's moving. And why is it moving? Partly because he knows he's at the end of his life. It's not, you know, he wakes up one day and knows, oh, this is it. Okay, time to say my goodbyes, you know, and that's it. And it's beautiful. And yes, you can't have that without this bit of it where he says, you know, the price you have to pay. All right, I got a shorter lifespan than everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's just it.
And he, like I said, I don't think he was really brought back to life. He was only mostly dead, you know. To quote Princess
Bride. Mostly dead.
You
know what the difference is between dead and mostly dead?
You go to their pockets and look for those change.
Yeah.
But no, I think literally he said, you know, I can't create life, but I can breathe life back into something if there are just a few embers left. So yeah, he was mostly dead.
He was mostly dead.
And you know,
sure.
You know, jump started the little Toyota Corolla or whatever.
Yeah, you know, I'm just saying.
Try and figure out, You've short-circuited all of his mitochondria, and Lorian comes and turns them all back on, but he can't keep them going forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Tim and I will agree to disagree on that.
Yeah. Right. I don't know what it is. I guess maybe it's like Mr. Gary Bali feels. He's up to something.
Mm-hmm.
That scene where he's sitting there watching the secure cam, and he's twitching, and Zach comes in, hey, you're watching the secure cam. Why don't you keep in tabs with the captain? No, him. Him. I don't know what's his deal. He's like bouncing off the walls. It's fantastic. You know, and Zach's just like, oh, okay. And I love Zach's whole thing, you know, and everything's like, yeah, you know, he's still sharing a ghost desire to him. He comes back, except he was dead. It's like, yeah, well, there's that. I don't pretend to understand it. It's just a little too big for me. So now, let's get to the next part of the apotheosis.
Mm-hmm.
We have Sheridan, who is going to have to, I mean, he doesn't want it, not in name, but he's going to use it as a tool. That's pretty obvious. You know, I mean, when he says we're going to take out the Vorlon, everybody's response to that is, oh my God, are you, what? It's like, yeah, I know. It's going to be tough. We're going to do it. Then we get to Cartagia, and it occurred to me watching this episode when Cartagia calls Londo out and tells him to look at the stars, you know, look at the sky, what do you see? This is glory, this is going to be the heavens, and Morden shows up. It was very much like the desperate putting their trust in the deranged. You know, Morden says, well, the Vorlons have gone mad. We're going to put our ships here on the island of Centauri Prime. You're going to send your fleet out to protect us, because if you put a show of force, the Vorlons won't bother with such a major planet.
Right.
And of course, yeah. And, well, you know, Londo's, oh, my God, we can't do that. And he turns to Cartagia, hoping to find one last glimmer of sanity.
Of reason.
Match this madness. Cartagia says, no, we're not sending the ships. And, you know, Londo's like, phew. Like, no, we're going to let the Vorlons come and burn everything, because that way I get to be a god.
It's my quickest way to heaven.
Right, right, exactly. So it's like the deranged, you know, the desperate putting their faith in the deranged. And I like that. It's like the shadows are so desperate. They are so not used to being in the position that they're in. You know, that I guess it's that arrogance again. It's like, well, they're going to do what we say because we're the shadows. No. You know, somebody with an agenda so completely outside of all those rules that the Shadows and Vorlons have set up. And that's, you know, the stakes suddenly get so much bigger. You know, Londo, who had been doing a good job of trying to walk that fine line to keep Cartagia, you know, try to keep a leash on Cartagia, where he just about loses it. You know, there's the scene where he's, you know, Cartagia says, you know, where he goes to Cartagia and says, okay, well, I got a plan on how, you know, if make sure that the universe knows about your godhood. And Cartagia looks at him, and there's, again, that glimmer of, you know, of cunning. It's like, oh, let me guess, you're going to leave the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can sing my praises from far, far away, huh?
Yeah,
you know, and there's
that whole scene just reeks of gameplay. He says, no, but if we're gone, who will remember you?
Right, and Londo's whole response, that's when one of those moments when he shows the fear. Because, you know, he's walking that line, he might have stepped over. Because, you know, Cartagia thinks that you're trying to ditch him. Well, you know, he's crazy enough to just cut off your head right there. But Londo, you know, he definitely plays it, And I like his whole thing about, well, you know, you should go to Narn and we'll try your car there, because, you know, he's maneuvering. And his response to Cartagia says, well, my advisor says it's too dangerous. Look, you're a god. You're a god. What do you have to be afraid of? Feeds right back to that vanity.
Mm-hmm. He's like, you have to let the universe, the galaxy, see you, because otherwise who will remember you when you're gone?
Right. Oh, I'll be right by your side when you attain your godhood. Like, oh, Londo. But yes, the stakes got just that much more high.
Delicate, very, very delicate balancing game he's playing.
Yeah.
He's trying to feed the ego without overfeeding it to the point where it'll come back and bite him or kill him. Interesting. That was a lot of fun. I loved Dude, I would so love to talk to Wortham Crimmer.
Wortham Crimmer as Cartesia. I mean, he just played that role to a T. I mean, he inhabits that individual like nobody's business. You know, just like I said, just when you think he's just loony, he turns dangerous. And that final scene where Londo says, "Well, everything's ready for heading for Narn," and there's Cartesia in the cell with Jakar, and Jakar, he just looks like he's beyond thought and reason. I mean, he looks like he's just hanging on because that's just what the body's telling him to do.
That's his pride. He's like, I have to keep going so that, you know, Malari can free my people. I have to keep going.
Right. Exactly. It's just it. It's not even. It's. I was watching it, and it wasn't even like there was any thought behind it. It was just like, I have to keep going, for no other reason than I just have to keep going. You know, there's nothing more beyond that. No saving worlds. No freeing people. It's just, I can't let go. And then, of course, Cartesian. I don't like the way he's looking at me.
the going back and forth, deciding which one. It was like, that was just eerie.
Like, right, and his whole, he's like, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, it's like, you know, what did he say to Talando? You know, the problem with being infallible is that you have to deal with people who are.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of his whole response. Like, which one, Majesty? It's like, you know, why are you bothering me with trivial details?
Meeny, miny, moe.
Yeah, it was just painful. I mean, they didn't show it. They closed the door. And you just know. You know, you just feel the horror. We also get to see Cartesia's shadow cabinet.
Mm-hmm. His heads of state.
Yes. Yes. Well, everybody knows that the one head right there is Andreas Katsoulis.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I forgot they did that.
Yeah. That was his. Now, listening to the commentary, if you remember in the scene as Cartesia's talking and he's, well, you know, he's consulting with cabinet, blah, 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 and he offers Londo a snack.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently that was, according to Jurassic in the commentary, that was improvised. Wortham Crimmer just did it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, exactly. And it is so perfect. It is such a perfect character bit. Because he's completely oblivious to the fact that he's got these heads just sitting there. Londo's about to lose his lunch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Emperor offers him a treat. Oh, he wants some.
It's not like he's oblivious. He just doesn't care.
I guess that's a good point.
Yeah, he's,
right.
He's like, yeah, I did this. I put them here for a reason. And this is my trophy room. You know? Other people had, you know, deer mounted on their walls. He's got, you know, former rivals' heads. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy, I tell you, he's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Insane.
Well, we are falling toward apotheosis. Things get very, very interesting. Things are coming to a head. There's a resolution of sorts ahead of us, but I don't know. It's going to be a very interesting ride going forward.
Yes.
I mean, we all know how it
turns out. We are now at the crest, at the you know, that very, very first drop of the roller coaster ride. we are now just climbing over the top, and we're about to go into free fall.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah. Well, everybody, you know, everybody's got their plans in place, you know, and it's all a matter, you know, things are being set in motion. And they're going to play out how they play out. It's marvelous. I mean, it's just, there's all kinds of little, you know, the way the characters interact, the dialogue, you know, when the fleet has assembled, there's Garibaldi and Ivanova talking, and he's saying, well, you know, what are we going to do afterwards? She's like, what do you mean afterwards? And he's like, well, you know, if we lose, we don't have to worry because there's an afterwards. But if we win, what then? What do we do, huh? And she's like, well, I thought I was the pessimist.
Oh, well.
Yep. All right. Well, anything else to cover for this one?
Not off the top of my head.
I will share you a couple things. Again, like I said, I watched the commentary, and while there wasn't anything specifically informative. For the most part, the actors were just kind of ragging on each other. They were commenting about the dents in Jerry Doyle's head. If you go back and look at the episode especially, they commented on the fact that Bruce Boxleitner had his lines written on Delenn's head bone.
I forgot about the dents in Jerry Doyle's head part.
Yeah. If you got the DVDs, go back, listen to the commentary. Just, like I said, don't expect a whole lot of facts, but just, you know, be prepared to laugh, because it is just, it's just pretty funny.
Cool.
So.
I guess that'll do it for Falling Towards Apotheosis. As always, if we miss something, let us know. We'll talk about it later. But for now, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this.
In the world of podcasting, danger lurks around every corner. Tech nerds hand out obscure expertise. Pseudo-psychiatrists give out free advice worth every penny. Sci-fi geeks stalk the unwary, unloading useless trivia. Podcast novelists plot to take over the world and threaten to swallow your soul. It all sounds like an adventure. And if adventure has a podcast, it must be Indiana Jim.
Join me, Indiana Jim, your intrepid arch-geekologist, as I navigate the podosphere. We'll talk to authors and podcasters on the front lines of traditional publishing and the new media, uncover creative audio treasures, find inspiration from the annals of history, and battle the enemies of truth, justice, and the sci-fi geek way.
Go to podcast.indianajim.net today and join the adventure.
And we are back, and we are still Vorlonless.
Yeah. So it goes. Well, you know, they've got plans to destroy, so they can't be bothered.
Planet killers to deploy.
That's right.
Yeah, right. Right. Shadows to rid of. Hey, James, I did want to ask you something. In Grand Babcast tradition, tell us briefly how you discovered Babylon 5 and what your experiences were like first watching the show.
To this day, I cannot remember. I think I just saw the, you know, the TV guide listing for the pilot and said, well, that looks interesting. I'll have to give that a look. And I watched the pilot and thought, gee, you know, this looks rather interesting. And then, it was a matter of, it disappeared. And then they announced the PTEN consortium, and Babylon 5 was listed as one of its kickoff shows. So I said, okay. But what really hooked me was Garibaldi's second favorite thing in the universe. when I saw somebody that realized that Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century was going to survive until 2257, I said, these people really get it, and I got to watch this show. And it was also the thing that gave me the first sense that, you know, Garibaldi and I probably would be really good friends, although he drinks and I don't, but that's...
Well, he tries not to, but
yes.
Yeah.
But it basically was that got me. As for other Babylon 5 related things, well, I actually sent a message to JMS once when I was going out to JPL and said, I'm going to be in the area, can I come by? And he said yes. So I actually went to the hot tub factory and spent the day there. They were filming Sick Transit Veer at the time. And I had the pleasure of watching the greatest single combat performance in Centauri history as Londo Mollari took on the bugs in his quarters.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And at the time, I was standing in Jakar's bedroom, which was the set that was off to the side. But it was, you know, it's one of those things where you're standing there. You can't say a word, of course, because that would freak out the sound guy.
Right.
But he goes through that scene, and I mean, he was really putting everything he had into it. You know, the crockery was flying. He was just stabbing into the ground there, and he pulls that bug up, and he's giving the line about, wait a minute. You were bigger than I thought.
I thought you were bigger.
There are more of you.
You are smaller.
And of course, they had to do it two or three more times, mm-hmm. because they needed all of the reaction shots and the close-ups and all that other kind of stuff. So he goes through it, and then they're going through the routine. Well, here's what we want you to do now. You know, raise your head up just above the level of the counter so we can see your eyes, and they go through and work through all of that. And then, of course, they finish the scene when Lindsay walks through the door, and Londo's eyes, you know, get really wide, and he's off to, and who are you? I also got to meet June Lockhart at the Spirit Landing. NASA had invited her as one of, because she's been doing a lot of goodwill ambassador type stuff. So I walked up to her and I said, may I ask you a question? And I'm sure she was thinking, okay, 50-year-old guy, he's going to ask me about Lost in Space. But I said, I would like to ask you about your performance as the doctor in the Babylon 5 episode, The Quality of Mercy. And she lit up and went on to say that, well, at the time, this was right after the Northridge earthquake. And so every time they would start a scene, there was always somebody there who would point at one of the walls and say, if we get an aftershock, that's the wall you run through so you can get out of the building. And then at the same time, she was working on one of the soap operas. I don't follow them, so I don't remember which one in particular, but she said she was switching back and forth between being the doctor with the healing machine, and then she'd go off and put on the little costume with the pillbox hat and sit in as a guest at a wedding. And she's flipping back and forth while she's going on with these things. So it shows up in some interesting places. And I actually got to meet the great maker. They told me he was editing down at the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences building, and they told me how to get there. So I drove down, walked in. He came out, towered above me, accepted my congratulations and kudos about the show, and sent me on my way.
Very cool. Very cool, James.
Very, very cool.
Yeah. Well, I was going to pass on something that Gary from Jacksonville had emailed to us, and I don't have the exact email in front of me, but I can paraphrase. Gary tells us that he's been going through the script books, and he's up to volume 14. And in one of JMS's introductions, he mentions, you know, all the various interviews and whatnot that he hears that talks about how Babylon 5 was such a special show, including podcasts.
Ooh.
So I think the Great Maker is still kind of checking in on us every now and again.
Cool.
Or somebody's bringing it to his attention. You might want to listen to this one.
Well, he makes a direct. He doesn't say the Babylon podcast by name, but in I want to say volume 9, where Marcus has the script where Marcus reveals that he's a virgin, whatever happened to Mr. Garibaldi, and talking about how at the time Jason Carter was, you know, just aghast at the whole concept, and they talked about it, and, you know, when it was all said and done, JMS asked him, are you okay with this? And Carter's like, yeah, sure, fine. And then JMS in his introduction says, I just recently heard a Babylon 5 related podcast interview Jason Carter where he's still going on about the fact that the character was a virgin. So we know he listened to that one specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who are new to the show, we have indeed asked the great Maker to make an appearance, and he very graciously declined, in part because he says he has his own venues to get his words out, and because he wants this to be a place where all the other people who are involved in the show can come and say what they need to say and want to say about having been involved in Babylon 5. So.
I think your knowledge just scares him. I'm sure that's it.
Who else would celebrate Snack Man? Come on.
Right, exactly.
That's true, love right. Snack Man.
Actually, I have one other thing. How much time do we have left, Mike?
Plenty.
When the script books started coming out and I started buying them, it occurred to me that somebody ought to be making sure that these survive historically. So I asked the Library of Congress if they were getting them under the their copyright allowances, and I'm pleased to say that as of now they've gotten up to volume number 9.
Wow!
Yeah.
And I hope they're working on all the others, and I've made them aware to make sure that they do get a volume 15, because of course the set won't be complete without it.
Right. And I think there's a deadline on that too, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I'm hoping, it may be dangerous to assume too much, but I'm hoping that the Cafe Press people and the library people have worked out the arrangements to make sure that it all gets there.
Yeah.
I suddenly realized, it would be really helpful if all the folks who listen to all of the Farpoint Media shows that with their science fiction expertise might be able to help the library assure that it has a full and complete collection of science fiction material. So I'm trying to figure out how to work that, but the folks there do seem interested. I don't know how to pull it off yet. We haven't really thought about it much more than that, but trying to have y'all
say complete science fiction collection. Well, I mean,
to check basically to check what's already in the library's catalog, and then if somebody with specialized and detailed knowledge gathered over millennium knows that they're missing an absolutely critical Heinlein piece or something, not that they probably are, but if there's something in somebody's bibliography that the library doesn't have that a specialist would think does need to be there, we can at least tell the library to go looking for it. They may not be able.
Is there some place online that listeners can go and visit and peruse a list?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to think. The URL for the catalog is.
It used to be thomas.loc.gov.
Now that's the legislative database. It's catalog.loc.gov for the library's holdings, and you can search in various ways. So I was thinking, somebody goes in and puts in their favorite author. Sees what the library has from that person, and then can say, well, why don't you have X or Y or Z?
They must have changed that recently or within the past 10 years, because that's what I searched to find out information on Miami Vice scripts that people had submitted. Unpublished. Unpublished. Unproduced Miami Vice scripts people actually sent to the Library of Congress. Can you believe it?
Oh yeah. Well, the library is the copyright repository, so people will submit their materials to it in order because that's part of the process of getting a copyright.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure that they don't do everything. It's the old joke was that they had to get two copies of everything that was ever
right.
ever copyrighted, but they space doesn't permit that.
Right.
But they do they do try to build up collections that they are interested in. And the other aspect, of course, is the video and audio collections, which the library also has. You'll remember, Tim, I sent you that little note about the first thing that they're going to digitize out there is the infamous Star Wars Holiday Special.
Ye gods, no. Oh, no. That needs to be lost to history.
Oh, no.
It really does.
So,
because you know that when 100,000 years from now, when the planet is barren and dead, that is the thing that the aliens will dig up and base the entire society on. All of humanity and all of civilization will be reduced to the holiday special of Star Wars.
We must go find this lost Jefferson starship. With it, we can rule the galaxy.
No. But the that division is trying to capture.
Can you imagine their entire basis of beauty would be B. Arthur?
Oh, that's wrong. That is just wrong. No wonder the civilization died off.
It's one of these nascent ideas that I have no idea at this point how to make it come off. But I was figuring that it's sort of the open source method of saving the science fiction genre, at least in the repositories, and. It's just something I throw out because there are a whole bunch of people listening to all of this stuff who live, eat, breathe, and know everything in great detail. And why not take advantage of that knowledge base?
That is a Herculean effort, but you know what? If you can make it, maybe you can pull it off, more power to you. That's great.
You.
We have enough projects. That's not ours.
Yeah. Oh, darn. I was expecting you to put up a web page.
Sure.
Nope.
Yeah, we'll get right on that.
Nope. Nope. Nuh-uh. Not happening. Nope.
Oy, yoy, yoy.
Yes. So, well, I don't know. I think we're done.
I think
so, too.
So do I.
Very much so.
As always, feel free to donate. We love you if you do.
Yeah. James is our favorite person right now.
So. Yes.
And Coralejo.
Yes.
I'm going to rub that in Jeffrey's face
yes.
next week.
What's that? Coralejo and
Anejo. Coralejo.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Yeah. So just go to the website babylonpodcast.com. Send us a donation. Check out the Far Point Castle in Second Life.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually listen to this feed. It should be streaming into Second Life. Hang out there. Play with the board while Mike's not in there. You can
check out the iPod.
Yeah,
there's an iPod on the counter now that you can touch, and it will give you all of the Farpoint shows.
Cool.
The iTunes links for all the shows.
That's cool.
It is.
Very nice.
Yeah, there's a Pod Culture tent right out front. There's a Astrocast pub.
Yes,
Saloon.
The Astrocast pub, and you can even dance in there now. They built the little dance API, the little AIs in there, so you can go in there and kick some music on and dance in the pub.
As always, if you want to leave us a comment, you can go to the website and leave a comment, or send us an email at babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Or
Feedbackapalooza coming soon.
Feedbackapalooza is on its way.
Oh boy,
yes.
More
feedback. Hey, every fourth show, Feedbackapalooza.
Yep. Okay, there you go.
You can also leave us a voicemail to be included in that Feedbackapalooza. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Your NASA didn't send a probe to Sierra Plan.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.